Okay, welcome, gentlemen. We are going to have the second half of the review for Spring 2018 Contemporary Halacha. We're going to be talking about Tumas Kohanim, brain death, infertility, mikvaos, and finish off with Hilchos Kiruv. So let's begin with Tumas Kohanim. So first of all, it's actually very appropriate because this week's parasha is Parshas Emor. And that's the mitzvah of not being the lenefesh lo yitama ba'amav. We have to realize that there are three types of tumah, of course, is tumah, three types of tumas: meis, maga, masa, and ohel. The question is, let me rephrase that. Tumas maga and tumas masa definitely applies equally to a Jewish and a non-Jewish corpse. The question is, does tumas ohel apply to a non-Jewish corpse? That is a machlokas. Rishon, Tanoim, Machlokas Rishonim, Machlokas Shulchan Aruch, and Ramah, seemingly. But even the Ramah, who's Mekel, Medina, that Tumas Akum is not Metamim, but Ohel, even he says one should try to be Machmir. Here, we have an important Ravid that relates to Kohanim Bizman Hazeh, which some might think to indicate what should be that there might be a Heter to allow Kohanim to attend medical school as far as even if there might be a mace in the room for anatomy or a skeleton in the closet in the hospital and the like. So the Ravid says the following. The Ravid says that once you're Tameh already, you are allowed to touch more Tumah. Let me rephrase that. If you're holding on to a corpse in your right hand, your left hand, everybody agrees you could touch something else that's Tameh. What would be, however, once you are no longer touching the mace with your right hand, could you go ahead and still, while you are a bit tumah, you didn't get to para aduma yet, but you are no longer touching the tumah right now, could you go ahead and touch a mace? Is that mutter or asr for coin to do? So here we have the Rambam says it's asr once you're poresh, and the Ravid says no, since you're not being mosif al tumas, you're not delaying your sprinkling in any which way. So the Ravid would say that nowadays Kohanim are tumay mace, and therefore, they by any given day, they could touch their tummy already, they could touch something else, and it would be mutter for a kohen bizman hazeh to become tummy, because it would just be mosif tuma al tuma. So if that's the case, so we're not going to rely on a Rambam, on a Ravid against the Rambam. However, says the Dugal Miravava, we have a svek sveka. When it comes to tumas ohel for a guy, so we could be mitzarev, the Shitos, the Ramah, for example, who's Mekel by Tumas Ohel, as well as the Shita, the Ravid, who argues on the Rambam and permits Tuma Bechiburin, that if you're not Moses, Tuma Tumaso, and we could create a sex faker that would allow, maybe there's no Tuma for a guy at all, to be good Tumas Ohel by a guy at all. And even if there is Tuma for a guy by Ohel, maybe we hold like the Ravid that would permit it once you're ready, Tami, and that would be a Svara to. That would be a svara to permit a kohen to go to medical school. However, this has been rejected by Moshe Feinstein, for example. First of all, the Ravid is a das yachid, and to use this as a sex vaker is hard. Secondly, even the Ravid, we see from Ravids elsewhere, that the Ravid might have been chozer bo, and even when the Ravid said that there's no problem of becoming tummy a second time, once you're already tummy, he might have just meant they don't get malkos, but not that it's actually mutter. So for these reasons, we do not permit this sveksveka of the Dugal Miravava to permit a Kohen attending medical school. Ramosha entertains the idea, what about you, the argument that it's pikuach nefesh, sakonas nefashos? Ramosha says that's bogus, because yes, if somebody drops dead in front of you, or drops on the floor in front of you, of course you have to save their life, but it does not mean you have to go to medical school so that you will know how to save a life. And furthermore, there are non-Jewish doctors, and there are non-Jewish, and there are Jewish non-Kohen doctors. So therefore, these svaras would not apply. Let's go to the next point, which would be, what about a Kohen going to visit a hospital for Bikur Cholim? So when you have the question of a gosase, even if somebody is not dead, they're just, you know, on their, you know, in a matzav of gesisa, so we have machlokas, the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah, whether a Kohen is even allowed to be present in a room of a gosase while the gosase is still alive. The Ramah is Mekel Medina, but he says again, Tov Lahachmir. We in a hospital, we have another issue. Besides, even if there's no dead body, there is, even if you don't go into the room of the dead body, there's another issue that arises. And that is the din called Sof Tuma Lotzeis. If you know that there will be a certain exit through which the body will be taken out, will be removed. So that location is, the mace is considered as though the mace is in that doorway even before they ever take the mace through that, doorway. If that's the case, there's a certain elevator or a certain entrance, you wouldn't be able to walk, Cohen wouldn't be able to walk in that elevator, even though there's nothing in that elevator now. The mace is six doorway, closed doors away, with closed doors, you know, prevent the tumor from spreading. But since the mace will be taken through that elevator already now, it's considered an issue.
Yeah, there's only problem once there is a mace, though.
Yes, if there's no mace in the building, then you can't apply sof to malatzes.
Even
correct.
If Mason would be
yeah, even if there, it's reasonable that every day or every day somebody's going to die in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. But that doesn't mean that if no one's dead right now, then there's no issue of sof to malatzes. Once there's a dead body in the building, then it will be an issue, of course, to be in the ohel with them. And even if you're not in the ohel, you're many ohelos away. There are closed doors, many in between us, but the mace will be taken out through that doorway. That would present a new problem, sof to malatzes. Perhaps we could define the kula for this if we assume that it would be, what would be the halach of, so would we apply sof to malatzes for a mace akum? In other words, in chutz la'aretz, where the majority of the maceim, even if there is a mace, would be an akum. So could we be mekel, again, sof to, I'm sorry, tumas akum, tumas oh, for an akum, I won't be mekel. But if it's sof to malatzes, maybe it's a little bit more lenient. So there are those who suggest that maybe the mitzvah, the din, the iser, sof to malatzes, is only because a yid has a mitzvah likvar. So he has to be, from a halachic perspective, he must be taken outside. Mashenk and a goy, there's no din, there's no mitzvah to be covering him per se. And therefore, there's no mechayiv that he has to go through out the door. So if that's the case, maybe we won't see it as though the mace is there right now in this doorway. We wouldn't apply the schumra of sof to malatzes. So there are those, Reshefter, for example, suggests that it's a, that sof to malatzes for a guy, that you could have sort of a, again, it's a chumra. So to say sof to malatzes on a guy itself is a chumra. The fact that there's all tumasal bechlal on a guy might, is itself a chumra. So you don't have to be machmir for sof to malatzes of a guy where it's a double, you know, chumra derabana, but most people reject that kula of Reshefter. Fine. As far as visiting sick people, Reb Moshe has a famous tshuva where he says that mikra hadin, one could rely on the rov that whatever dead bodies in the morgue are goyim. Again, this applies in chutz la'aretz presumably. And mikra hadin, you could rely on the rov, and that they're not matami ba'o. Mikra hadin is not matami ba'o. So we have enough to rely on v'shas hatzar, v'shas hadchak, b'tzorach gadol, shalom bayis, a close relative, a spouse, where it's absolutely necessary for a kohen to visit them, then there is room, ikur hadin, to be lenient. But, you know, more than that, it would be better to avoid. The next point is, what about if you have a ishes kohen who is pregnant? So theoretically, if it's a girl, there's no prash. She's not mitzuva in Tumas Kohanim. If she has a girl baby in her belly, that baby's not mitzuva. The question is, what if it's a boy? Especially because the pasuk in this expression says, L'hazir gdolim al haktanim. Sorry, the chazal on the pasuk. Say, L'hazir gdolim al haktanim. It's a responsibility to be worried about the ktanim even also when it comes to tumasala. So here we have another sex faker. The Rukav says that a woman who's pregnant, an Ashes Kohen, can go to a levaya because of a sex faker. Suffolk, maybe it will be a nefil, maybe it will be a ben kayama. And even if it will be a ben kayama, maybe it will be a nekeva. Suffolk zachar, suffolk nekeva. On this, we have the Magen Avraham asks a very simple question. Why do you have to come on to that kula, that sfek sfeka, typically, that it's tara balua? You know, the tuma balua is now doesn't become tame. And as long as the baby's inside of the mother's belly, the baby's tame, and it should not be able to contract tuma while it's balua. So Reb Chaim Ozer in Achiezer answers with a tremendous chiddush in Hilchos Tumas Kohanim. And that is that tuma, the isra of a kohen, is not to become tame per se, but rather to be in proximity of tuma. Therefore, even if I tell you that, for example, the baby won't become tame because it's tuma balua, but since the baby will be in proximity, the fetus will be in proximity of the mace, and in the ohel mace, that would still be what it would be usur for the kohen to do. That's how Reb Chaim Ozer answers this question of the Magen Avraham. By the way, this sex faker that we just suggested, that the Rokech just suggested, would not really apply as much nowadays, because even if we still have a Safek Nefel, Safek Ben Kayama, because we don't know how the pregnancy will end up, but if we have an ultrasound, or if she could do an ultrasound, so you no longer have a Safek Nefel, Safek, maybe if it's like before, I don't know, when the ultrasounds are, Michael, no, you just got married, you didn't have a baby yet, I'm sorry. I don't remember at what point they could tell the gender, but before that point, you have the sex faker. But once it's, I don't know, 20 weeks, 30 weeks, or whatever the cutoff point is, then you no longer have that sex faker. Just do an ultrasound if she wants to go to an olavaya. This achiezer that we just suggested, this chiddush nora v'atzim, that the isser for a kohen is not to become tamei, but rather to be in proximity of tama, might also explain another halacha. That is a halacha called cherev harehu kechalal, where we say that any, the Rama says that any time there is a piece of metal that was in the ohel of a mace, that would render the kohen can't even become tummy to that. Tosfos asks, what do you mean? Every house in the world has a piece of metal in it that had become tummy to a mace at some point. Why should how could a kohen ever walk into a house? So according to the Achiezer, you could answer that because if the kohen is just coming in connection to the house, not the actual mace, yes, even though tuma might be there, but the kirva to the tuma, that isn't there's no dead body here. The kohen's not coming in proximity to a dead body, and that's not going to be usher in the issur of tumas kohen. What was your question, Michael?
Render? The art test, getting some fluid from the
amniotic sac, that's also after a certain point. They only do amniocentesis after 16 weeks, I think. After 12 weeks, I think. At least 12 weeks.
So you're saying it would be required to do something like that?
If she wants to go to a funeral, so why should she rely on a sex fake if she could be mevara when the svekas? I'm not saying she should put herself in a sakana. There's a tiny sakana with amniocentesis. There was actually a young lady who I met who was missing part of her body because when she was a baby, they did an amniocentesis on the mother and the amniocentesis needle touched part of those cells that ended up, should have become part of some of her limbs. And she actually is missing some limbs because of the amniocentesis that she got. Again, the chances of that happening are one in a who knows what, but there is a potential danger. So, yeah, sonograms are safer though. Fine. Let's talk about.
What was the halacha, whatever you supported?
Cherev harehu kechalal. Okay, a car. Could you drive in a car that's going over a cemetery? So, theoretically, if you're in a box, the box that you're in should make you protected from whatever tumah surrounds you, because that box should be an ohel in and of itself, and therefore it should be chotzis b'fnei tumah. However, a car, for two reasons, might not be able to be chotzis b'fnei tumah. First of all, it's an ohel zarok, it's moving. An ohel zarok is not an ohel, and therefore the car, being in the car, will enable you to contract tumah. Secondly, even putting aside ohel zarok, the car is metal, and the only kind of ohel that could stop tumah from penetrating is a non mekabel tuma material. However, metal of the car is mekabel tuma, and therefore will not be able to be chotzeis mepnei hatuma. While we're talking about this issue, that brings us to similar questions of airplanes, where you have a few issues. First of all, the airplane flying over a cemetery. And even if it's not going to be directly over a cemetery, you have an issue of a kohen sitting on the passenger section above the cargo, where apparently, I understand, the majority of El Al flights out of JFK, rove of the flights do have a dead body in the cargo hold. Rove, yes, rove. I understand. So we're going to also have to wonder, are airplanes going to be able to protect the kohen inside? And I heard pointed out, I was listening to these halachas Rari Leibowitz, Shlita from North Woodmere, from our yeshiva, pointed out that it's not just usher for the kohen to be with a mace. if a person's burying their body, wants to bring their body to Eretz Yisrael, it's usher for Yisrael to be metame a Kohen. So what right, if there's going to be a jumbo jet with 500 people on board, how many of them are going to be Kohanim? You know there are going to be at least 5, if not 50 Kohanim on board. If that's the case, what right, I'm sorry, just the males, or it could be, so let's say there are 500 people on board, 250 men, what percentage of men are Kohanim? 10%? Okay, so there's going to be 25, there's going to be 10, there's going to be 3, there's going to be one Kohen on board, definitely, on every Elal flight, there's going to be a Kohen on board. What right does any grieving family who wants to send the body of their mace to Eretz Yisrael have to put the body on board and be metame a Kohen? Okay, so let's talk about airplanes for a minute. Airplanes, let's say it's flying over cemetery. So we could say, oh, the same idea. Maybe it's chotzeitz, the fact that you're in your own ohel, your own box, that should protect you. No, because it's a ohel zarak. And secondly, the fact that the walls are mekabel tumah. Well, here we have a different question, because although certain metals are mekabel tumah, what about metals of airplanes? For example, most airplanes, the more recent airplanes are carbon, the most recent airplanes are carbon fiber, which are not mekabel tumah, it's not metal. However, you know, the 5-year-old airplanes, which most of the El Al fleet, I would assume, are aluminum. Is aluminum one of the metals that's mekabel tumah? Because if you open up a chumash, the Torah only talks about 6 metals, being es habdil, es zahav, es hakesef, es hafaras, es hanachoshes. Those are the only ones that are mekabel tumah, but aluminum is not listed there. So here we talk, I have a machlokas rishonim and achronim. The Gras says only these 6 are metal, and therefore aluminum plane would be a good insulating box that would therefore be chotzes b'fnei atumah. Others say no, since metals in general have the same properties as those 6, they're malleable, they're ductile, do you remember from physics or chemistry in high school or college? They have the properties of metals, so all metals that we call metals on the periodic table would be mekabel tumah, and therefore would not have the capacity to be chotzes b'fnei atumah. Rav Schechter has liked to point out that if a plane is flying over 3,000 feet above a cemetery, so even if we say that the plane is nahal zarek lo shmei ohel, and the plane is metal and it's not, and it is mekabel tumah, and therefore it cannot protect the kohen from the cemetery on the ground, but still, according to the yisod of the Achiezer that we mentioned earlier, this is now the third application of the Achiezer, the isra for a kohen is not to become tamei per se. Yes, he would become tamei, but it's to become karov to a mace. And if you're 3,000 feet in the air, that's not karov to a mace. And therefore, even though the kohen would become tamei, it wouldn't violate an isra because you're not, the kohen's not coming in close proximity to a mace.
That wouldn't help.
That would not necessarily help you with cargo. Yeah, cargo would be a different issue. So first of all, I do understand that El Al has a plastic box in the cargo hold that they insert the mace in. So plastic is not mekabel tumah. So that might be a saving grace to be chotzeitz b'fnei atumah, keep the tumah insulated in this box so it doesn't go upstairs to the cargo, to the passenger section. The problem is, some posts can say, but wait, this box is on a plane. The plane is flying. So that means this entire entity is an ohel zarak. And we say that an ohel zarak is lav shmei ohel, so therefore if it's not shmei ohel, it's not its own unit, it doesn't contain the tumah b'fnei, because it's an ohel zarak. So then we have to question, is a plane with the person on the plane, the kohen in the passenger section, relative to the dead body below, there's no movement. He's not ohel zarak. Or would you look at it the other way and say, no, the whole plane is an ohel zarak, so the plane itself, nothing in the plane, can be chotzeitz. Another point is that even if the box itself is plastic and not mekabel tumah, but what's holding the box there? Why is the box not flying down to the ground and crashing into the floor, into the sea? Because it's being held up by a plane. And the plane is held up, even if you hold it's not metal, the plane is held by iron screws, which are metal, l'chol ha'dayos. So it's still maimid b'dav asher mekabel tumah, so therefore, if something is maimed, but davar shemekabel tumah, that still might take away the ability to contain the tumah, and therefore it would be great if a kohen could avoid being on a plane with a mace in it. So there is one flight every day from Newark, an El Al flight from Newark that doesn't have a dead body on it. If a kohen should strive to take that flight if they can. Okay, others of course are makel based on the various svaras that we've given. Okay, that's the end of Tumas Kohen. Let's go to the next year. The next year, we'll talk about brain death. This, I believe, is a very important question because more often, it's a funny thing. This is my first Shaila when I became a rabbi. Before I became a rabbi, I became a rabbi September 1st, 2015, of my new shul. So I was enjoying my last Shabbos of freedom. I say it was like August 27th or something. I said, Baruch Hashem, I'm going to go to my mom and dad for Shabbos, because after, you know, starting September 1st, I can never go to my parents for Shabbos, Yontif. So I'm packing up all the kids, we're in the car. As I'm getting into the car at about 5 in the afternoon on a let's say Shabbos at 7:30, driving, about to drive to Brooklyn, I get a call from somebody who's not in my Baal HaBas yet, from my new community. They didn't have a rabbi for a year before that. So he calls me up and say, Rabbi Orlian, I'm sorry, I know you're not officially the rabbi yet, but my mother is, and I have mamsha life, end of life shaila. Life, literally life and death based on what I, you know, whatever the shaila was. And I was like a little overwhelmed because it's 2 hours before Shabbos and I had never had this shaila before. And I sort of knew or was aware that it's a gigantic machlokas. Even the two rabbanim who I had spoken to about that shaila on that Friday afternoon at 6 o'clock, well, I think I had to, my wife drove so I could make all the phone calls. You know, big machlok, halacha lemaisa. So brain death is lemaisa, unfortunately. Should never come your way, but again, there are other end-of-life issues in terms of DNR. Those are more common. But end-of-life issues, the brain death will become more common as people ask you if they could sign an organ donation card. So first we have to just realize that there was some history in the 1700s that in Europe there are some countries that made a legislation that you couldn't bury a body right away because the bodies might not really be dead. So the poskim, the way they related to that is they said, no, that's garbage. Yes, there could be a chashash. Is that a chashash pikuach nefesh? No, there's no chashash pikuach nefesh. If we assume that he's dead, and we're not going to wait the 3 days that the governments wanted us to wait. There is an issue of halonos hameis. If we assume he's dead, fine. Because again, this shiloh wasn't that it wasn't a function of new technology, a function of new invention. It was just maybe we're missing the boat. So nothing changed. The Chasam Sofer says nothing changed. We have a mesorah of what death is. So if we, according to our mesorah, death is death, so they're dead. But now let's go into brain death per se. I'll try to make this simple. I know in the discussions it's a complicated point, but I'll try to break it down as simply as I can. There are two parts of the body that we have to focus on. There's a brain and a heart. The way the body works is like this. Once the heart stops, nothing else will work. However, that is not true with the brain. The brain could stop, and even after the brain is not working at all, the heart will continue pumping as long as it has oxygen. So now, before there was such a thing as a ventilator or a respirator, which pumped air into the lungs artificially, so if a person stops breathing because the brain doesn't work anymore, so if the brain doesn't work anymore, so they don't breathe anymore. If they don't breathe anymore, what's going to happen, by definition, within a very short amount of time, within very few minutes, the heart will also stop. So whenever there was a brain-dead person, the person also stopped breathing. If there was no air, no oxygen, then the heart also stopped. So there was no shaila to discuss. However, with the invention of the respirator, the ventilator, that it does blow air into the lungs, so you could have a brain that's not working, and even if the brain is not working, and therefore there's no breathing on its own, but the respirator, the ventilator does the breathing for the person, and that will allow the heart to continue pumping for, could be, in most cases, might be only days, but potentially could be years after the brain is entirely not working whatsoever. So the question is, do we say that since the brain is not working at all, the person's dead? If that's the case, well, his heart is still pumping, and the oxygen, hemoglobin, is still traveling to all the limbs, and that means all the rest of his body is in great shape, and all the rest of his body could be, you know, removed from this body, which is, we'll consider him dead and insert in a living person to help the living person. Or do we say, what do you mean? Yes, his brain is not working, but his heart is pumping. How can you call him dead? His heart is pumping, he's alive. If he's alive, you take out a limb, you're killing him. That's called Ritzicha. That's the question of brain death. So Harvard came up with a decision with the definition of death. Who are Harvard medical people? Who gave them the shush to decide what death is? Well, you need it for insurance purposes. You need it for policy. Does that mean that they're right? No, it doesn't mean they're right. It just means that for you have to have a working definition. It has nothing to do with what the Torah defines as life or doesn't define as life, so we couldn't really give a hoot what Harvard doctors decided in 19, whenever that was, in the late 60s or 64, 70, early 70s. So they decided, and we came up with certain parameters, that if certain things happen, the brain is not working, then the person is dead, even if the heart is still pumping. And that decision of the Harvard Medical School criteria was the working, the way many insurance agencies and medical agencies and hospitals decide that the person's dead, even though the heart is pumping. So does halacha agree to that, in which case halacha would permit organ donation? Or does halacha say, hey, the heart is still pumping, he's still alive, you can't do organ donation? So let's talk about two sources in Shas, and those will be the sources that, only really two sources in Shas that relate to this. Source number one, Gemara in Yuma Pehei, says that if a person falls under an avalanche or the house collapse and you want to check and violate Shabbos, do you have a class here? Do you have a shiur? We'll move. We have another 20 minutes.
No, 516.
Oh, 516.
You don't have shiur.
516 is open. Is that right? Is there someone 516?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Okay, I'm sorry. I was told that there's no shiur. Okay. I'm sorry for that delay. Okay, let's continue. So there are two sources. Gemara and Yuma is speaking about a case where somebody is house collapsed on him. You want to check if he's alive and violate Yisurim Doraisa to save him. So you have to check the body to see if the body's alive. Says the Gemara, how do you check? You check machlokas, either until his nose or until his heart. Machlokas. Sounds like, if we just read the Gemara in its simplest form, it sounds like, what's the machlokas? Machlokas is, do you look at heartbeat or do you look at breathing? What determines whether a person breathes or not? Their brain. Their brain tells them to breathe or not to breathe. Or their heart, which could continue beating even if there's no breathing. And if there's no brain function, the heart can continue to beat. Sounds like we have a question, is brain death death or not? Okay, let's take it a step further. I am going to fall off this in a moment. We are the Rishonim all paskin. How do we hold in this machlokas heart or nose? The machlokas says chotmo, breathing. So it sounds like the Gemara is paskining that if you look at his nose and he's not breathing, he's dead. Which means that if the brain stops work and he stops breathing, he's dead even if the heart is pumping. Sounds like brain death is death. Hold on, please. The Gemara then continues and says, this machlokas only applies not from starting from head down, but starting from feet upwards. Meaning, if you are checking the heart, some say that that's enough to check. If there's no heartbeat, that's enough. Some people say, if it's in, and then the Gemara continues and says, if there's not enough chiyus in the heart, then you have to go continue further upwards in the body and check the nose. Which means that... This is Rashi's comment. Rashi adds, let me say that again. I'm going to take that back, I'm going to say it again. Rashi explains this Gemara and says, why do you have to check, again, the Gemara tells us that we have to check foot, for meaning first from the heart, then the nose. The Machlok says, if you check the heart, do you still have to check the nose? Rashi explains, and this is the punchline. Rashi says, sometimes you can't tell if there's a heartbeat or not, and you could tell if you check the nose. In other words, Rashi's saying the two opinions here are not whether the nose defines death or the heart defines death, but rather there's only one thing that defines death, and that is the heartbeat. Sometimes you can't tell, you can't feel a pulse, you can't feel the heartbeat, Rashi says. So therefore you have to continue checking to see if there's breathing. If there is breathing, you know that there definitely is a heartbeat. According to this, according to the way Rashi reads this Gemara, it would be clear that what there's only one criteria of death, and that is the heart. If you find the heart has stopped, he's dead. If you can't tell, then you have to see if there's anything else that might show that he's dead. But if that's the case, that the heart is the determiner of life and death, according to Rashi's reading of the Gemara, that would mean that brain death is not death. And therefore, organ transplants would not be permitted. Let me clarify this with one point. We might have read the Gemara, that the Gemara is telling us two opinions how to define death. Whether death is defined by the heart or defined by breathing, which is controlled by the brain. Rashi says, no, it's not a machlokas, what is the definition of death? Rather, everyone agrees that the definition of death is the heartbeat. The question is just, what's the simen? What's the indication that there is no heartbeat? Is enough to just check the heart? Or even if there's no heartbeat, maybe it's just you missed it and you could tell that the heart has stopped because the person's no longer breathing. And therefore, according to Rashi, it seems that we're not talking about what is death, rather how do you tell if there is death? That's the machlokas. But the definition of death would be the heartbeat. According to that, if the heart is beating, the person is alive, and therefore brain death is not dead, and therefore organ transplant would be prohibited. That is the first source that we have to speak about. According to Rashi, a brain dead person is still alive.
Why is it meant to do take out organs out of someone who's dead?
If someone is dead, there's no problem taking organs out. But if somebody's brain dead, we call that brain death is a funny name that the Harvard medical community created, and the halakha calls a person alive. His heart is still beating. If he's still alive, so you can't take organs out of him, you're going
to
kill him. Yeah, but if you're going to save a life, we might be willing to suffer nivel hames, whether it's derais or derabbanan, and we're willing to suffer a little nivel hames to save a life. But we're not going to kill somebody to save a life. Okay. The last source for brain death, the second source, is a Mishnah Alos. Mishnah Alos is talking about who's tamei. It's not talking about Chil Shabbos, it's talking about Tumah. It says the following, that if a head is decapitated, even if the body is jumping around without a head, like a chicken without a head, literally, so that person, that corpse, is tameh, which is funny. Even though there's motion in the body is flapping its arms, is jumping up and down, but it doesn't have it, it's been decapitated, that body is still tameh. So there are four ways to understand this Mishnah. What is the significance of this decapitation? The Rabbanut says that if the head is chopped off, so he's not breathing. If he's not breathing, he must be dead. And therefore, as long as there's no breathing, as long as he's not breathing, that's considered dead. And that's the Rabbanut's opinion, that brain death is death, and therefore organ transplants would be permitted. That's the Rabbanut's opinion. It has lots of questions on it, which we're not going to get into now. Rav Tendler has a different way to look at it. He says, also, like the Rabbanut, that brain death would be dead, but the way he looks at it is like this. He says, if you look at a person who's decapitated, the Mishnah tells you that they're tummy, meaning the dead. You know what, says Rav Tendler? I have another way to decapitate somebody. You don't chop his head off, the brain died. That's just like being decapitated. It's not physically slight, his head chopped off, you know, his head is over there and his body's over there, like Esav and Maaseh Machpelah, but rather, his head's attached on his neck, on his shoulders, but his brain is dead, and it's just like decapitation. Because his brain isn't doing the job that it's supposed to be doing, the Mishnah is telling us that person is dead. That's a very difficult position also, because there are government reports that say that even when the person's brain dead, there's still body temperature that's being maintained, other things that are being maintained by the brain dead brain. So how can you say the brain is completely meaningless when it is doing some stuff for the rest of the body? Okay. Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Schechter, somewhat differently, says something very different. You know what this Mishnah is teaching you? This Mishnah is teaching you that any vital motion, any movement in the body means that you're alive. Except if the head is severed from the rest of the body, then that movement, which we call pirkus, right? You chop off the tail of a lizard, you do shechita, if we get to do the shechita. The body of the animal still moves. That, the Mishnah is mechadish, that's not called movement of life. But any movement, save that case, any movement less than when you decapitate it, all other movement is considered life. And therefore, for example, if the heart is still beating, that's called life. Any vital movement is called life. And therefore, as long as the heart is still beating, the body is alive, the person is alive, and therefore, chas v'shalom, you can't take an organ out of that person. Brain death is not brain death. That's Rabbi Bleich. And the last opinion...
That's because the person's head is not chopped off.
Correct. When we talk about brain death, we're not talking about a head chop being chopped off. That's just what the Mishnah was talking about. And we're trying to extrapolate from the Mishnah's case of a head chopped off how we would apply it to a case of brain death. So the way Rabbi Bleich understands it is, you see from the Mishnah that the only time that the motion of the body, the body's moving and still we call him dead, is because the head was chopped off. Other than the head being chopped off, then any other motion of the body would render the person alive. So therefore, if the heart is beating, you see there is motion to this body, the person is alive. Finally, Rav Shlomo Zalman has a fourth opinion, and which we're not going to get into. Okay. Rav Shechter's understanding of brain death, as again in the simplest form, is that the Gemara tells us there are shlosha evarim shanashama tuya behem, the heart, the brain, and the liver, and we don't know whether, in order to be dead, one of those has to go, or a person is only dead if all three of those, all three of the neshamas, shanashama tuya behem, are gone. And therefore, it would be a suffix if somebody's brain is not working, but their heart is still working, it's a suffix if they're dead or not. And therefore, obviously, you wouldn't be able to kill such a person who may or may not be dead or alive. So therefore, brain death would, you would not be able to have organ donations according to that. Fine. Okay, let us go to the next, that's the end of brain death. Let us go to the next year. Do you want to do mikvahs or infertility? Mikvahs? Okay. Let's go to mikvahs. So, we're going to break this down into three or four parts. First part of the shir is, what is the status of she'uvim, drawn water? So, it's machlokes whether she'uvim is pasul midoraisa or derabanan. If you assume that it's derabanan, the reason for this derabanan of mayim she'uvim, mayim that's in a bucket, is a gzera that you might be tovel in a kli, and that's against the pasuk. The pasuk says that it has to be tovel in the ground. We're saying that's part of the ground, and a tevil in a kli is pasul midoraisa, and to use water that came from a kli, that would be an issur derabanan atu tevil b'kli. Others say she'uvim is asur derabanan, but it could be that she'uvim is derabanan only if it's rov she'uvim. That's taka how the Ramah holds. The Ramah holds only if rov shuvin is pasul midoraisa, and that brings the issue with piping and tap water, that the water passes through certain points in the piping system that would render all of the city water, the tap water, to be considered mayim shuvim. So if the majority of the mikvah would be made out of shuvim, would probably we'd assume that it would be pasul midoraisa. There are two ways that we could take non-mikvah water, tap water, and be machshirah to be mikvah water. One will be hashaka, one will be zriah. Let's talk about those two ways. So in order to do hashaka, hashaka is to connect, you have one bar of tevila next to a bar of megashamim, and a hole in between them, that is kishwaferes hanol, which is two etzbaos chozrim, the amount of space that you could circle two fingers comfortably, that width of a hole will mix these two waters to be considered together, or flow one to the other, and therefore if you have that open for a moment, one with the other, so you have your tap water sitting in a pool. That's where she's going to dip. You have the mayim megashamim next to it, you open up the hole for a second, the waters connect for a moment, you close it quickly, and you just kashered that whole pool of tap water to now be considered mikvah water. That's hashaka. That's how most poskim assume. However, there is one opinion that is of Rabbi Yerucham, and the Rav Shach says we should be machmer for this, that in order to be able to be tovel in that tap water, it's not enough that they were once connected to the megashamim. It has to be b'shas tevila connected to the real mikvah, the megashamim. And that raises significant problems, because if that's the case, then you're going to have the water, the clean water of the tap water with the megashamim, which has been there for a long time, is dirty water, and the dirty water is going to go into dirty based tefila water is going to go into the megashamim. And another problem is that the attendants might forget to open the hole, b'shas tevila. And another problem is even worse, is that what happens if you fill the new pit, the bar tevila, with new water, and people start going in, and then the attendant forgets to open the plug between the two boros. So she's mamas going to be going in May Shuvim, which is Pasal Daraisa if it's Rav Shuvim. So therefore, because of these various concerns that you have, especially when you try to leave the mikvah open, we have another solution. The solution is Zriya. Zriya is a different way to machshir mikvah, and that is, Zariah is to plant. You take a kosher megashamim mikvah, and you just pour tap water straight into that. What happens when you have a pit a certain size that gets filled up with more water? It just overflows. So you planted water in it, and the water then flowed over into the next door pit. That new pit that you're pouring water from the tap into mikveh A, of the megashamim, it gets planted in the megashamim, now is kasher, all the water that goes in is kasher. And that mikveh A, which is the geshamim, and is kashering all the tap water, will overflow to the next pit, which will be your beis tevila. That's how Zriya works. What's the problem with Zriya? The problem with Zriya is, if you do this a few times, at some point, how much mei geshamim are you going to have left? If you keep on pouring water and letting the whole water fall over, at some point, you're not going to have you're not going to have rainwater anymore, majority rainwater. So most geshamim are not bothered by this. But there's a Raavad. The Raavad says you always need Rov Mei Geshamim. This is called the Sugya of Nasan Sa'a V'Natal Sa'a. If you have a Kasher Mikvah, you pour in a Sa'a of tap of Mayim She'uvim, and you take out a Sa'a from the Mikvah. So at some point, if you do that enough times, you're no longer going to have, based on statistics, you're no longer going to have, and the distribution of the water, you're no longer going to have a majority of Mei Geshamim anymore. So that will be a problem. So the solution to that problem would be to combine a bar tevila to have both a zriya and a hashaka. So you'll have a base tevila in the middle. Connected on one side, you'll have a hole to a bar hashaka. On the other side, you'll have the bar zriya that's overflowing. You'll have, so you're starting with an empty pit in the middle. That's where the lady will ultimately be dipping. And then on each side, you have a bar gvishamim. The bar zriya, you're going to pour tap water into the bar zriya. It will overflow and fill the new mikvah. Oh, you're worried that by doing that too many times, there's no longer mei geshamim in that bar zriya. That's okay, because you're simultaneously going to open up the hole on the side of the mei, bar hashaka, and connect it. And the hole will be open, and that way, you will have all the issues will be taken care of.
What about problems with the bor hashaka, the dirty water, and all those concerns we had?
Unless you do a zriya into the hashaka, I don't remember. I don't remember offhand. The Chabad have a different version of a bar hashaka, and they have a bar al gabe bar. Because the concern that we have is that if you have a bar hashaka, one of the concerns was that the water where she will be tovel will end up getting dirty, or the dirty water of the megashon will end up, if you have it open, getting into the bar tevila, and it will end up being dirty water. So the Chabad says just do a bor al gabe bor, meaning have the megisham on the bottom. Since the water is cold, and that water from the gisham is cold, that will stay low. Whatever water you add on top will stay on top. And there won't be so much interchange between the waters, and there could be a hole on the bottom of the floor where she stands above the bor gisham, which is below her. The problem was that the Divrei Chaim HaSan says that this vertical hashaka is not considered a chibur because of Mishnah in Mikvah says katafra seino chibur, that means a vertical component chibur is not considered okay. So most people have no problem with that, but the Divrei Chaim said no, that's called katafra seino chibur. Nowadays, however, most Chabad mikvahs are fine because it's not a pipe that connects the upper bar to the lower bar through a vertical chibur of a pipe, but rather it's like one big pit that happens to have a almost full slat or floor in between, splitting the upper mikvah from the bottom mikvah with a hole in it. So it's not like two mikvahs that you're connecting with a chibur. No, it's one big mikvah with a split down the middle. Fine. One last point for the shir, and that is two small points, actually. One is hamshacha, one is zochlin. Hamshacha is if you take water that is tap water, and you let it run on the ground for three tefachim, I think for three tefachim, does that machshir the mayim she'uvim and make it kosher? So there's machlokas if that works to be machshir an entire mikvah of she'uvim or only for a miut, like one sa'a of she'uvim. We are machmir, we hope that it only helps for a miut of the water, but there is an opinion of Tosfos who says that if you do hamshacha of 40 sa'a mayim she'uvim, that would be machshir the mikvah. So therefore, because Tosfos' opinion will allow us to, you know, even if we mess up on everything else, if you just do hamshacha, then that will be machshir all the waters coming into a mikvah. So we do hamshacha on all the waters, all the tap waters that are coming into anywhere. We'll do it via hamshacha. So at least according to Tosfos, we fulfilled the din of we solved the problem of she'uvim. Hold one more point. The last point of the shir is zochalin. That is, even there are two kinds of bor. There are two kinds of mikvahs in the world. There's a mayan and a mikvah. Mayan is flowing water, and that's fine. But a mikvah is not allowed to be flowing. And therefore, if there's a mikvah that has even a crack in it, or it's the filter is on, or it's a lake and a river, and there is an out, what is coming in, what is going out, of there's an underground spring where the lake is letting its water out, those will not be a kosher mikvah, because it is a mikvah, it is not what's called the water, it's not spring water, it's rainwater, but it's rainwater that's flowing, that has a leak, that has a crack, that is flowing through a filter, and that would be a psul of zochalin. That's the end of this shir. Yes.
So hamshacha like removes the status of shuvin from the water. Previously, it was like recesses.
Yes. Yes. If you take a tap and run it on the dirt for three tefachim, it no longer is considered shuvin anymore. That would be what the hamshacha accomplishes. Yes. An inflatable pool that is filled with rainwater is pasul midaraisa. It's a kli.
Even though it's a kli rishon, isn't it?
That's correct. Even though the rain fell straight into the kli, it's being tumbled in the kli, it's pasul daraisa, I believe. If it would be attached to the ground, that's a different story.
This might be really weird. Let's say you have a filter that's attached to a pool that's plugged into the wall. Is that not considered a carcass that's attached to the ground?
The filter is plugged into the wall or the pool is plugged into the ground? The pool is attached to the ground. If the pool is attached to the ground, so that would be a kosher mikvah. So you have to figure out how the filter is working. I can't get into that now. Okay, next shir will be on infertility. Second to last shir. Just some interesting statistics that I think it's helpful for a rabbi to know is that in any given month in normal, again, without any external forces, the probability, again, normal woman, normal man, no birth control, no other games being played, the probability of pregnancy in a given month in the general population without any external factors is 25% in any given month. In a year of trying, 85% of couples, again, in normal circumstances, would conceive, again, for a younger woman, and once the most important factor in fertility is the age of a woman. So it drops a little bit at first, and then at upper years, in the upper 30s and lower 40s, it drops drastically. Also important to know that 15 to 20% of couples are going to have some fertility issues. So that means if you have a shul of 100 young couples, it's reasonable to assume that 15 of them are going to have some fertility issues. So it's a real, very serious, it's a large number. Let's just understand how the cycle works so that we can understand what the halachic issues could be. The cycle, the 28-day cycle would be as follows. The first 14 days of a woman's cycle is the time that it takes for an egg follicle to grow and grow and grow and grow. On the 14th day, the follicle bursts and the egg comes out and is drawn into the ovaries where it waits for the zera to impregnate that egg. Now, the place where this is going to come into halachic significance is the following. If a woman has a short cycle, a long cycle, let me add one point. Those are the first 14 days. So the first 14 days it takes for the follicle to, for the egg to sort of be released That's called ovulation. The next 14 days is the seeing if the egg develops, if it was impregnated and develops, and will attach to the wall of the uterus. If it doesn't, after those extra 14 days of buildup, then the lining inside the uterus, called the endometrial lining, will shed out of itself, come out of the body, and that's nidus. If the egg that came out on the 14th day, on the ovulation day, didn't, over the next 14 days, catch with anything and build up, then it will come out of the body. That's meinida. So, for example, if a woman tells you that she got a hysterectomy and they removed her uterus, then there's no nida to talk about. There's nothing, you know, she could be bleeding from today till tomorrow from osa makom, but it's not blood from the endometrial lining in the uterus. There's nothing to talk about. Okay, so what we have to know is that the last 14 days of the buildup of the endometrial lining, that lining inside the uterus to prepare for conception, to hold a baby, is that's standard 14 days. What can be variable, can change, and determines the length of a woman's cycle, is how long it takes for that ovulation, for that egg follicle to burst and release the egg. Is it 14 days? Is it 12 days? Is it 16 days? So if it takes 16 days for the egg to develop, then it's going to be 16 for the first part, and latter 14 will always remain standard. It will be a 30-day cycle. If the first part of her cycle will be 12 days to develop, then it will be those first 12 days plus 14 days, which will be standard. So it will be a 26-day cycle. So when can pregnancy happen? So as Dr. Levine pointed out, that pregnancy will happen if there was zera a few days before, the day before, or on the day of ovulation. But if the zera comes in after the day of ovulation, there is zero chance for pregnancy. So what does that come out with? That comes out, why is this? Because at the moment of ovulation, there's the mucus prevents the zera from going where it has to go. But that's, so what happens if a woman has a short cycle? What does the short cycle mean? That means that her egg was released not on day 14, but on day 12, let's say. So she ovulates on day 12. Let's say she doesn't end up going to the mikvah till day 13. We just said that if the zera comes in after the day after ovulation, there's a 0% chance that that zera will be able to impregnate her. So if she has a short cycle, and which means that the first half of her cycle is shorter, which means that the ovulation was earlier, which means she ovulated early, and she can't have the zera come in till after she ovulated, so there's an impossibility of having a child. So again, so just to realize how incredible HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up Hilchas Nida, the days that are highest for fertility are days 12, 13, or 14. Once you get to day 15, it's meaningless. When does a woman, according to normally go to the mikvah on day 12? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up the system the day of the mikvah, and the day or two immediately after the mikvah is the ideal day for fertility, and after that, it falls away. So if a woman does indeed have a short cycle, so there would be two options, really, to solve her problem, this halachic problem. Again, for a guy, they could just have Bia whenever the cycle, if let's say she ovulates early, so okay, so have Bia early. But for us, she'd be a need at that point. So that one option would be to medically give her hormones or medications that would make her ovulate a day or two later, so that she could ovulate after she gets to the mikvah. Let's say she goes to mikvah on day 13, so we're going to make her ovulate on day 40, so she has one day that there could be conception before the ovulation. The other possibility is IUI, intrauterine insemination, meaning take the zera from the husband, and while she's in Ida, before she goes to the mikvah, take the zera of the husband and put it, implant it in her, not through a bias, Yisr Chas V'Shalom, but take the zera from last month, or a zera from the husband now, if the post can allow it, and insert it into her, and even before she goes to the mikvah. So there's no bias sister, but she still has zera in her when she's not yet at the mikvah, but before she ovulated. Fine. Let us talk about one last two more points, and that is Point number one is, what would be the various methods for producing zera for the doctor to analyze? So it's very fascinating to note that Dr. Levine, because he's a firm person with the sensitivities, he says he would never start with checking the men. He would always start checking the woman first, so that it would, because halachically, there are no questions about checking the woman. If you start with the semen analysis, that would start with questions. So you start with other tests first before, and whatever they could do for a few months before having to go to the semen analysis. So what would be the ways that to produce the semen for testing if it would be necessary? So obviously it could be, as you know, coitus interruptus. That would be one possibility, which is fine medically, and then he'll be motzi zera, he'll be dash bifnim, but be zorik into the zora b'chutz, into a container. But obviously that's an iser, but medically that would be fine. Or a better halachic solution would be to be with a condom. Of course, it can't be the regular ones that are over the counter, because those have a spermicide built into it. So it has to be a special one that they have in fertility offices. There are some, specifically Hasidim, who are even more machmir, that say even if they would be permitted to be motzi into that condom, into the wife, obviously, but to have some kind of needle hole in the end of the condom so that some will get into the wife and most of it would be maintained in that pouch. Another possibility would be just let the husband and wife be together normally and do an inspection on whatever is in her after the bia. That's called a PCT, post-coital test. Coital is bia, which many doctors, if they're not so flexible and accommodating for from people, might say, I'm not interested in doing this, doing that. I want to just check, the best way. But Dr. Levine said it is possible to check at least, if he checks and he sees that the zeras are moving well and are doing what they're supposed to be doing, so he knows it's fine. If it doesn't, then you're right, it might not be the best test. And finally, another possible is what he called postcoital efflux, whatever comes out, drips out of the woman in the hour after the bia, so that could be taken to the lab and also inspected. And there's no even shaila with that, but again, if it's not a perfect test, it's a one-way test. If he finds that the zera that are discovered there are strong, so that the zera is fine. But if you see that the zera is not strong, it might just not be a good test. Fine. Okay, that's the end of this section. Any questions on that, Shira, before we get to the last one? Yeah. That was the last one that I said. That was the last one that I said, that the postcoital efflux, meaning after their husband and wife are together regularly, and then puts a little container underneath her for them, whatever drips into that naturally will be what they'll check. Okay, we're now going to go to the last shir for today, and that is Rabbi Mordechai Becher's shir on halachas of kiruv v'chukim. First of all, we're going to list off about 8 different sources in Pesukim that would demonstrate the mitzvah on a deraisa level to be involved in kiruv v'chukim. So number one, avas Hashem, which the mitzvah avas Hashem is, as the Rambam says, not just that you love Hashem, but that you call others to love Hashem. Right? If you love President Trump, you want other people to vote for President Trump. The message is that you love him or whoever else. Next mitzvah, of course, is the mitzvah of tochacha, which has its various parameters. Tocha might only apply b'shas maisa, might only apply to people who are from. It might only apply to. You have to be careful with the mitzvah of lo tisal avchet. That's the mitzvah of tochacha. Hashavas aveda. The Gemara extends Hashavas Aveda to apply not only to Hashavas Mamona, but also to Hashavas Gufo. Based on that, Achronim applied a third level, also to apply to Hashavas Nafsho, to Avedas Nafsho. Furthermore, fourth, lo samal da dam reyacha could be not only physical dam, but also his spiritual dam. Fifthly, the mitzvah of chesed, the greatest chesed, is not just to help sick people and go to Camp Hask and Camp Simcha, but to teach Torah. Sixthly, Talmud Torah, of course. Talmud Torah, the way the Rambam presents the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, is not just that you learn, but that you teach your children and your Talmidim. Seventhly, Vahav Torecha Kamocha, well, that's sort of the mitzvah of chesed, I should have put that together. The way the Ramban defines, I think it's this way, past week's parsha, this Ramban. I almost spoke about it in my drasha, because I heard it from this year. The Ramban points out that the mitzvah of Vahav Torecha Kamocha is that you should not just love everybody more, you can't love more people more than yourself, but just like for yourself, you want the best for yourself, you should want the best for others, including, says the Ramban, their success in Torah and in mitzvos. So that mitzvah, Avas Yisrael, would be mechayev you to seek that person has the best Torah and mitzvahs they could have. Additionally, we have Arra Shalot here. So, Losa say Arra Shalot Yakim es Sefer HaTorah HaZos, which doesn't just mean that you should do Hagbah, but also means you don't enable people to keep mitzvah. So there's a mitzvah to, yes, enable people to do Torah and mitzvahs. Finally, the mitzvah of Arvos, it's not a mitzvah, is it a mitzvah? I'm not sure. But that the way the various Rishonim say that you are not fulfilled in any given mitzvah yourself. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah of Shofar unless you ensure that every other Jew in the world has fulfilled their mitzvah. That, as far as... Oh, there are two more. Well, we have a list of almost, 10 or 11. Ubiyata harami kirbecha, Rabbi Yonah says that this is not just killing those who are chayv misa in Basin, that's the fulfillment of Biyat harami kirbecha, but also is to bring people closer to Torah mitzvos. Finally, Kiddush Hashem, which the Rambam describes as being mefarsim Hashem, being mefarsim his mitzvos. That's the end of this section. Next section. What's the status of a non-religious person, right? We know that if a person mechal shas before hesia, he's a mumar, kovid avodah zara, dino kagoy. The question is there are a lot of people who are mechal ali Shabbos. That means they're all dino ka'akam. So here we found through the generations numerous svaras to say why our tinokas shenishpu will not be considered Dinamka of the Avodah Zarah with all the severity of the halachas of an Oved Avodah Zarah that are associated thereby. So number one, it could be that in order to be a Mechal Shas B'Farhesia, the Farhesia means Adam Gadol. So like the story of Rabbi Levin, that there's a guy smoking in the prison in Yerushalayim, and they heard that the rabbi was coming, so he swallowed his cigarette. Meaning, yes, he's Mechal Shabbos B'Farhesia, but not in front of, a tzaddik and Adam Gadol. Hudner says further that for Hesse might need 10 Shomri Mitzvos. So, hey, if you have a guy who lives in who knows what town, he might never have seen 10 Shomri Mitzvos in his life when he's Mechal. So when he drives up and down the streets of Dayton, Ohio, it could be in the streets that he drives down in Dayton, Ohio, they don't even have 10 Shomri Mitzvos on that street in Dayton. Some parts maybe do, but not his part. Additionally, in order to be Mechal Shabbos, it has to be that he's amazed. And Chazanish says that it has to be, what does amazed mean? Amazed means that you even know that it's with kares. It's not just made, I can't drive on Shabbos. That you have to know that if a person drives on Shabbos, that it carries a chiv kares. I assure you, most irreligious people don't know that what kares is, or certainly not what skila is. Tosus says that mefachal Shabbos perhaps is only if he's a rugil in it, so if he just does it here and there, that might not qualify him as a rugil, as a mefachal Shabbos perhaps. So, Lemaisa, based on all these comments, most non-religious people today have a status of a tinok shenishba, and therefore they could even possibly be mitzdaif to a minion, because it could be that we try to be machmer by wine, but other than that, we generally do not assume that a mechal shas perhesi is dino ka'akum. Ramosha says you can mitzayif to him to a minion if he believes in Hashem, so he's mitzayif. His bracha is a bracha. If he says, and I had this shayla in Shank, there's a fellow who walked into Shank Shul with earphones on, and he said, oh yeah, I just took the, he was a little bit interesting, and Big earphones, very big earphones. Earphones that you could see from the balcony. Not the, you know, not those pods that you just slip in your ear. Big earphones. This is going back a few years ago, I guess, before those little ones were cool. And he used to say, Rabbi, I grew up in my conservative temple. I got my aliyah when I was bar mitzvah. I want an aliyah today also. I came all the way from the Bronx. How do you get here? I took the B12, the Q, whatever. So the BX 32 plus right across the bridge. I want to bring an aliyah just like I got when I was over. So first Shabbos we gave him Galila. And kept on coming back to me. So next time, maybe we gave him Hagbah at some point. Kept on, no, I want Aliyah. So I asked with Shat. The Shat said, look, if he comes because he believes in it, he believes the brach and he wants it. So, Mikra Hadin, that's his tshuva Ramosha, you can give him an Aliyah. You should just know that I found that older people have a much more difficult time with this kind of psak than the younger generation. Younger generation is much more open. So you know, you're not really religious. You could get away. Sure, let's bring you closer to give you an aliyah. The older generation, you should just know from my own experiences with younger generations and older generations, it's very difficult for them to give me a guy who's machal Shabbos an aliyah. What a chutzpah it is. They feel Shabbos in a way that the younger generation, myself included, don't have that deep appreciation of. Weiter. Let's talk in the latter section of this shiur about different applications of lifnei iver. Specifically, giving food. If you're going to have an outreach program and you're going to give them food, so that should presumably be an iser of lifnei iver, like the Gemara says in Chulin Lo Yitein Prusa Ela Yodeh Shuyitol Yodav. They're not going to wash in the Tilsa Daim. You're not allowed to give them bread. And Rabbi Yonah extends it that if you know he's not going to make a bracha, you can't give him food at all. So any outreach program, you have to put up a big sign. None of these sushi, meet and mingle and learn. None of these latte and Torah things, because they're not going to make a bracha. Say, come and learn Torah, and we don't give you any food, because you're not going to make brachas. So will that work? So you have a heter of Rabbi Yonah who says that if the kavana, it starts like this. Are you allowed to give tzedakah to a poor person who won't make a bracha or won't do it until he dies? So Allah says, for tzedakah, you're allowed. So Ben Yonah says, if for tzedakah, you're allowed, you see that if the intent is for doing a mitzvah, then it's okay. And certainly, kiruv rechokim is a mitzvah, and presumably that would perhaps be a heter. Then it still suggests that if it's only if you hand them and they eat it right away, but if they walk away, you don't see what happens, that might also be okay. Chazanish has another heter. We have a Mishnah in Shviyas that says you could give demai to aniyim. Well, I could give demai to aniyim, because if you don't give him demai, he'll violate. One second. I have to check exactly how he says it. I'm not sure how he says it. But the point is, again, I'm not sure exactly what the Chazon Ish said, what we're gleaning from the Chazon Ish. The point is that if you violate, if you don't give him this, if you don't give this person food, he'll end up violating a worse iser of los isna sachicha b'vavecha. He'll become more distant from Yiddishkeit, and therefore, if you don't give him food, you seem like a callous person. He'll dislike Torah. That could be worse than the fact that you're machshil him and not eating and eating without a bracha. Worse so, you're machshil him and hating other Jews and hating Torah. Furthermore, this is very practical. If you do feed him that there's one last meal, he's going to go to McDonald's because you just gave him kosher food. So that's very practical, yeah.
Why is it we're not able to violate brachos by, let's say, Torah and all these other things, and not
make up
by non-mushal wine?
Let's do that question for now. Let's continue. Okay, next question, which is very nogei lemaisa, is that issue, again, of lifnei iver, a different application. But this is lifnei iver to invite somebody to come for Shabbos. So here, Rav Moshe Taka never addressed the question directly, but in his discussions of having these educational minyanim for children, non-religious children, on Shabbos, where they would have to be driven to shul, Rav Moshe writes in two shulis that it's absolutely terrible, and not only are you you're educating them to drive to shul. And that's, the poskim assume that Rav Moshe probably would assume the same thing. If I say, come to my house for Shabbos meal, and you have to drive, what are you teaching him? So, Rav Moshe seems to be machmer on the sugya. Rav Moshe Sternbach, however, has an interesting heter, and that is that just like the Rambam says, by chovel b'chaveiro, It's only aser if it's derech meriva, derech nitza meriva, meaning that you try to hurt somebody, that's when there's an iser chova. But if you try to help somebody, you know, do a surgery on him, that's not chova at all. So too is mechadish Moshe Sternbach. Lifnei iver is only if you're trying to mess somebody up. If your ultimate kavana is to help somebody, so even if practically you end up making him violate something, but it's with the goal of bringing him closer, that would be permitted. And in that shuvah, Moshe says there would be three conditions. First of all, your intent has to be for kiruv and not for social concerns, which comes up very often with bar mitzvahs. You make a bar mitzvah and you want to invite your non-religious cousin. Why are you inviting your non-religious cousin? Because socially you have to, or because they're going to be turned on from having a Jewish experience at your bar mitzvah? So it depends. If you're doing it because of social reasons, that they invite you to, you know, Julia's bat mitzvah, so you have to invite them to your son Yanki's bar mitzvah, so that's not a heter to invite them if they're going to drive. Also, you have to make clear that you prefer they don't drive. And thirdly, they shouldn't pull up in front of your house. They shouldn't pull up in your driveway. You should park a little bit away and walk, so it's not an issue of marasayim. Another heter that numerous posts from David Cohn, Rabbi Forrest, by me, and Farakwe, Rabbi Shafter, and others, say, based on a different svara, there's a Mishnah Shvius that says that you're allowed to give a Chashal HaShvius a shovel. Why? Because you could use a shovel for both things of Heter and things of Isser. If that person chooses to do a Harisha, HaAsura, that's his problem, not your problem. You gave him something that he could do either way. If you give a plow, it's Asur because you're enabling him to plow. If you give a shovel, it could be used for Heter and Isser. He chose to use it for Isser. Similarly, if you invite somebody for Shabbos, with the option of coming before Shabbos and sleeping over, you present him the possibility of being able to keep Shabbos. They might also drive. So if they make the choice and say, I'll come but I'll drive, that's them making the decision, not you, and they will not be lifting either, because you presented a situation with a possible heter, possible Isser. They chose the Isser choice, that's not your problem, it's their problem, no lifting either. Just another one or two points, and which we'll finish. It's important to know that pikuach nefesh, that distorting Torah is aser, could be even for pikuach nefesh, because we see that by when. Okay, we're not going to get into that. I finished off with the question: how could you daven for someone to do tshuva? After all, lo b'shamayim hi hakol b'dei shamayim chutz miyur shamayim. So Moshe Feinstein says the tefillah, the idea of davening for someone to do tshuva might be, again, they have to make their own decisions and do their own tshuva, but you're davening that they should meet somebody who will inspire them, or that they should be in the right kind of Shabbaton circumstance that where they could do tshuva. Chazanish says, no, an interesting, beautiful pshat, that Klal Yisrael is all one guf echad. So you davening that somebody else should do tshuva is all like he's davening. You're allowed to daven that you should do tshuva because it's all part of our free will of us being a united person. And that's another heter to daven for somebody else to do tshuva. Bez Hashem, we should all be zochah to do tshuva. So, as far as details are concerned, 1 week from tomorrow will be.